Welcome to TYT Interviews. I'm Anna Kasparian, and we have an important interview for you guys today. We will speak to a reproductive rights activist. Her name is Katie Klobusek, and she has worked tirelessly to defend women's reproductive rights, especially at a time when we have conservative politicians that are doing everything in their power to violate reproductive rights. Katie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna.
So, Katie, one thing that I really find fascinating about your work is how you're trying to make it easier for women who seek an abortion by not allowing certain protesters to harass them when they go to these clinics. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Depending on whether or not there are buffer zones or any protections for the clinics, different parts of the country, all you have is the FACE Act, which is the federal law that basically just says you can't chain yourself to a clinic door, but doesn't do anything for people chasing patients into traffic, surrounding medical transport vehicles, preventing patients in physical distress from accessing their doctors. So in places where there isn't a lot of protection or even a lot of help from law enforcement or city officials, clinic escorts wear vests. We kind of look like crossing guards. And we stand outside as an extension of the clinic to provide some semblance of safety and security for patients on sidewalks.
That's amazing. So can you give me a few examples of, what these protesters do to either intimidate or harass the women as they're going inside these clinics?
I try to distinguish between the vigil style protesters, so the people that are really just off to the side with a rosary, praying their conscience. Some of them will stand with pamphlets and, say, I'm here to help, but without chasing people around. Then there are the picketers, the people who say things like, mommy, don't kill me. Mm-hmm. In Chicago now, they're writing on chalk at the sidewalks leading up to the clinics. So things like, what if I have your eyes, mom? Mm-hmm. And they'll yell at the top of their lungs in Jersey until a couple weeks ago when they instituted a buffer zone. You could hear them for 4 or 5 hours at a time without stopping. So loud, you could hear them in counseling rooms inside the clinic or in procedure rooms, yelling racial slurs, misogynistic slurs, weird, anti-Semitic slurs and comparisons to the Holocaust and slavery. I mean, it's almost unbelievable.
So what I'm always kind of curious about is how people determine whether or not they cross a boundary when it comes to protecting the women who go into these clinics, because there is a very fine line, and it is important to protect freedom of speech and also protect reproductive rights. So how do you determine when you would want to step in if these protesters go out of line? When is it considered out of line?
Typically, what we do when we're escorting is to greet a patient before they get to where the picketers are harassing them. So we say, hi, I'm with the clinic. I'll walk you past the protesters if you'd like. Mm-hmm. If they decline, they can walk, just walk on their own. Usually there are escorts sort of along the way. If they change their mind, when they get closer to people who are screaming, we'll be there. But we're not the police. We're just there to offer literally a shoulder or a shield to surround and walk them in if they choose. And really, it's just up to the patient. It sounds weird to say, but I could care less about the picketers. I'm there to make the patients feel safe and comfortable. Mm-hmm. So whether or not they've crossed a legal harassment line is really up to local law enforcement and whether or not they want to impose things like noise ordinances. And if there are things in place to keep the clinic safer, like a buffer zone, the one in Massachusetts that's in front of the Supreme Court says you have to be 25 feet away, which still allows you to speak your mind. I mean, that's a lot closer than the buffer zone we have for polling places. And that, arguably is actually a political act, unlike what's happening at clinics where people are trying to go to the doctor.
So another issue that I'm seeing popping up is these pregnancy crisis centers. And they usually have them right by abortion clinics. So if a woman does want to get an abortion, she will sometimes be tricked into going into the pregnancy crisis center, which looks a lot like a clinic. It's done that way on purpose. And they go in and there's some religious person literally wearing a white coat, posing as a doctor, and then giving the woman misinformation about what an abortion can do to her body. body. One of the common lies that they tell women is that, hey, you know, you're going to get breast cancer if you go through with the abortion. Of course, that is absolutely false. Is there any work that you've done to kind of combat some of the misinformation that these clinics are sending out to these women?
That isn't my particular field of expertise, although I spent a lot of time across the street from crisis pregnancy centers just by virtue of being in front of doctors' offices. So I've talked to city councils or other activists who are doing just to get an idea of what the lies are on the sidewalk that get them into the clinic. Things like, you know, we'll help you, we'll offer you free care, which isn't true. We'll help you after the baby is born, which typically also isn't true. Things like we have free ultrasound, which will be true, but then they try to convince you to have the pregnancy. So it's a lot of hoping for regulation and asking for regulation. Bill de Blasio got elected saying that he was going to regulate the crisis pregnancy centers. And mostly it's just making sure that women who are in the vicinity know that it's not a doctor's office. Yeah. If they choose to go there, if that's the care they're seeking, if they really are seeking religious counsel and that kind of guidance, obviously it is their choice to go there. But we try to be there to say, just so you know, that it's not a doctor's office, it's not a clinic.
What do you think it is that made conservatives use this particular issue as part of their platform during the 2012 election? And I would argue that this is the type of stuff that led to their demise in the 2012 election, focusing on social issues and the culture wars, as opposed to our economy and issues that actually matter. What do you think it is that made them decide, hey, you know what, abortion and violating reproductive rights is the right way to go?
Part of it's a split. You guys talk about this a lot, where the GOP's gotten more extremist, at least in the primaries, and the funders are very extreme and very, very conservative and very right wing. So part of it is playing to their base. I mean, people like Mike Huckabee, who arguably as governor of Arkansas wasn't so awful. I mean, he wasn't great. I wouldn't have voted for him, but he instituted a birth control mandate for the state of Arkansas. But now when he speaks to funders, possible funders, sorry, he has to say things like, you know, you're going to Uncle Sugar to get your birth control. So part of it is a funding thing, just who has the money and the way our election system is just awfully designed right now. And part of it is that marriage equality doesn't get people to the polls on the correct side for them anymore. They're not winning on that issue. And the only social issue they've got left is my bodily autonomy.
Which is incredible, because I think that they're, I mean, on one hand, I would argue that that particular issue led to their demise in 2012. But at the same time, I mean, in state legislatures, they've been pretty successful in passing anti-abortion legislation. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, is there a particular state where you feel that the restrictive laws are particularly egregious?
Gosh, I wish there was just one state. Mm-hmm. what happened was 2010, people didn't vote, right? So we got the Tea Party wave, and those folks controlled very often both houses in their state legislatures as well as the governorship, and they just got to pass whatever they wanted. And so we're seeing places like the western border of Idaho to the eastern border of the Dakotas. There's a 1,200-mile stretch, so that's several states, but a very wide area where you can count in single digits the number of cities that have abortion clinics. Because the strategy has been, since around the early 90s, when they discovered that they couldn't pass sweeping legislation at the federal level, they were just going to try to close the clinics one by one. So all the trap regulations that are for women's safety, things like requiring admitting privileges that aren't necessary for a procedure that only sends one in a million people to the hospital, these sorts of things are what they're using. As far as they're concerned, they've got all the money and all the time in the world, and every clinic they close is a victory. So they're just doing it that way, hoping no one will notice mm-hmm. what's happening just in that one place around the corner. But like you said, what people are discovering is that as more clinics close, more areas open, like the Rio Grande Valley that has no clinics. Now people are driving 10 hours, 12 hours round trip plus waiting periods. The more that happens, the more people are waking up, and it's getting harder to just sneak that stuff through.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of these states have been successful, red states like Texas, the Dakotas, you're absolutely right. What do you think the outcome will be if it becomes less and less accessible for women?
Well, we know that the abortion rate doesn't come down when it's not legal. That's essentially what they're doing. They're trying to make it completely inaccessible. So there's a phrase in Texas right now around the border, the flea market abortion, because you can get those drugs just without instructions. So women are doing what they have since the beginning of time. If they're pregnant and they don't want to be, they're finding a way to try and end it. They're just not doing it safely. It's why I always try to remember to frame it not just as a religious versus secular issue. Groups like Catholics for Choice, who have for the most part an older membership, they're part of that social justice wing of the Catholic Church, not the don't use condoms wing of the Catholic Church. And they were around before Roe, you know, back when Catholic hospitals were doing a lot of really good work. They were literally putting women back together. So there are really good coalitions available if we could turn to each other and say that this really is about women's lives. And if we take the morality side back and say, you know, this isn't just, oh, not my life, my whole life and my family's life. 60% of women who have abortions have children already. This should be an important issue for everyone. And if we can frame it that way and not let the right hang on to the morality frame, we can get a winning issue going forward.
You're absolutely right about that. And I would love to remind the audience that we spend $11 billion on unwanted pregnancies in the United States every year. That's part of the reason why President Obama wanted to increase accessibility to birth control so people don't have to have abortions. And a lot of conservatives were against that, which seems insane, especially when they're so concerned about abortions. Katie, you're doing amazing work. I really appreciate you coming on the show. And I do want to let our audience know about your website. It's katiespeak.com. They can read more of your work. And again, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime, Anna. Thank you so much.